Welcome to Imagine This Podcast,
the show where we discuss, celebrate, and highlight all the excellent and abundant arts and culture in Milwaukee.
We hope that after listening to the pod, you'll see and experience our city and the incredibly vibrant arts and culture community in a new way.
David, hi.
Hello, Lindsay. How are you?
I'm fine. This is weird. We're here without Max, so I think that means this podcast intro is going to be like real business-like. We're pretty serious compared to Mac.
Well, I can be the agent of chaos, right? I can talk about how you made the proposal that you should be the only person interviewing Adam Carr because, you know, because of the topic at hand.
Don't lie to our listeners, David. I'm not lying.
I'm actually just telling the truth of what happened in an alternate universe, right? Because if in the world of the multiverse is true, then everything has happened. We just happen to be living in this one.
Mac, please come back. This is too too peak, David. Too much for me. But listeners, you will hear Mac later. He actually did do the interview alongside David with Adam. But, you know, then he had to hop on a plane immediately after to head to a boys' trip to Las Vegas. So good luck. Good luck in the gambling world that I know nothing about, Mac.
There's no joke about that. That's also the most Asian thing that he could do, is have a conversation about being an Asian here in Milwaukee and then get on a plane to go to Las Vegas.
Yeah, sure. You said it.
I'm literally trying to get you caught and get you canceled. I'm literally trying to like cancel Lindsay on this podcast.
Oh, not today, David. Not today. Your
hackles are up. Your hackles for the Cancel Lindsay show are up.
Oh my God. Well, since Mac isn't here and I'm desperately trying to move on to another topic,
why would I try to cancel you on your work anniversary, Lindsay? We are here to also celebrate you.
I don't know. Mysteries abound. But you're right. So just recently we celebrated, though we did not start on the exact same day. We started close
Very
enough
close,
that
yeah.
we can do a combined work anniversary celebration. So this marks 2 years / an eternity of working at Imaginative KE for both
the
Mac
salt
and
mines.
I.
As Mac would say, yeah. grinding it out in the salt mines, the Imagine salt mines.
In the salt mines, but actually in our homes in the middle of a pandemic for the majority of our time here. So I guess I can think about some reflections to offer, but also what do we want to celebrate or roast about Mac since he's not here?
He's not here to share with all of you about how I feed him millet gruel to keep working in the salt mines of Imagine to pump out
that is a classic Mac-ism.
That's right.
What else does Mac say that we like to poke fun at?
You know, I would invite him to to step up to the craps table and win that quadruple parlay so that he can fund the rest of our work for the next 5 years. That would be an invitation to him on his trip to Vegas.
That's right. That is a classic. Mac can invite you to do anything and in a warm way or possibly a slightly snarky way, depending on the situation.
Build the pipeline. Wait, Lindsay, here we go.
Build the pipeline.
Building the pipeline of engagement.
Yep, that's right.
You can't see, but I'm making the ASL sign language sign for building the pipeline that Mac made up yesterday.
Mm-hmm. He's a big fan of saying that he's extroverting his thinking, which I really enjoy and picked up myself because it's a good way to say what I'm saying out loud is not a final thought. So don't judge it yet. I'm just extroverting my thinking. I think it's actually a pretty good tool because you want to be able to have an environment where people can share what they're thinking without feeling like it's going to be like judged as the final thought right away. So I think he's helped us cultivate that. What else? What else do you, as his boss, what do you want to celebrate about Mac?
You know, I think Mac has been, I think most of our staff are, but I think you and Mac actually together have been just incredible partners on being a great sounding board for all the ideation that happens around here. And I think there's never a good, never a bad idea that sort of passes through here. And sometimes, as I've been sharing with a lot of folks these last few weeks, that like, you know, given some of the challenges we've been facing as a city and as a as an arts community, I think it's really important for an organization like us to continue to put a lot of bets out there, because something's going to hit. And I think for having a team, having you and Mac working with us is just a great creates a really fertile place for many of these ideas. And that's my celebration of both of you.
There it is. Feels like a little bit of a cop out, but I'll take it.
Why is that a cop out?
It was a combo. No, it's great. I mean,
You are sort of our imagined twins, right? Because you guys started around the same time. Twinsies.
Imagined twins. Wow. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, it feels remarkable that we're already 2 years in. And, you know, when you start something new like this, you think in terms of like a couple years out, 5 years out, like, where are we going to be at? And no one, of course, could have anticipated that about 18 months of our first 2 years would be so heavily impacted by the state of the world and the state of the pandemic. But I feel energized that the work is definitely not done, and that we're still in this state of evolving, because we have to be able to react. You know, that's the benefit of being such a new organization. We are still forming in a lot of ways, and so we can react to what the sector needs now that we are thinking about what it looks like to revive out of this time. So cheers to 2 years.
What did you, so in that old meme, like how it started, how it's going, like what would be your meme for you at 2 years?
So if the meme was me, because that's just where my mind is going, like pictures of me, not necessarily like related to the organization or system at large, but just myself, like how it started would be me like fresh off of a chaotic but more corporate work environment, like in a suit jacket, like, here we are, let's do this thing. And now it's me in like whatever clothes I happen to be wearing at my desk in my home, unshowered, but like still super fascinated, just a little bit haggard compared to 2 years ago. How bad is that answer?
No, I think that checks out. It's probably true for a lot of folks, but checks out.
Yeah.
Well, so here's the thing, right? I guess the question we have in front of us, right, is that like over the last 2 years, there's been a lot of change, and I think that's the thing that if we're able to take advantage of and really sort of meet the moment and actually help shepherd through this moment of change, is going to really be the testament not only to the success of our organization but to the success of the sector at large. And this is a great transition over to the main conversation, where we're going to bring Adam Carr in to talk about some of the changes that may be happening over at the Oriental. Since 1927, the Oriental Theater has been a place for Milwaukee to convene and show incredible movies throughout the years. Yet over the last years, its name has been called into question. And so Mac and I, after the break, are going to have a great conversation with Adam Carr, who, as many of you know, is Milwaukee's story collector, who he spoke at the Milwaukee Films Cultures and Communities Festival on this very topic about the name of the Oriental and how Milwaukee Film is sort of orienting some of its programming and its space and all of that stuff towards the future. We're super excited to have him here today to help us unpack this question just a little bit further. After the break, Adam Carr.
So delighted to have with us Adam. Hello, sir.
Very nice to be with you guys.
it is a genuine pleasure to meet you. I know you and David are longtime friends. You both own timeshares that then neighbor each other. I get that.
That's right.
I'm new to the Adam Carr experience, but I've read your stuff and seen you about town. So for me, it's just fun to be with you in person.
Well, I have some swamp land.
exactly. Oh,
down
more.
On the south, deep south side that I
have. Deep south side.
We can talk about some packages that I have going. Awesome. Give you a real good rate.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. Great. Really good APR, affordable rates. But actually, and we're not talking land in South Bayview. That's a new neighbor to Crafton.
South Bayview is what, Franklin?
Right adjacent to the leather tannery. It's adjacent to the leather tannery. But all serious, we're really excited to have you here. I know you're in so many compelling conversations, so we're so excited you finally got you here. Before we get into the heart of the matter, which is the Asian caucus and the laws we will pass in the Milwaukee Asian caucus. Seriously.
The preamble.
The preamble to that. But tell us the story. We always ask our guests, tell us the story about how arts and culture, a specific experience that left a strong imprint on you. It could have been during your formative years. Could have been last week. We just want to know something that you experienced that had deep resonance for you. And we'd love to hear why it has deep resonance for you.
Yeah. So I am the son of an art therapist. My mom, I'm the youngest of five. And as I was kind of growing up, my mom decided to go back to work. She got her master's degree at Mount Mary in art therapy. And I went to like preschool while she was down the hall taking her classes. And, you know, my mom brought me into all these different, you know, like I was her guinea pig. So I, you know, when we made
homework, you were homework.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was like, will this work? So you know, she eventually had a creative arts studio that was attached and to DreamWorks, to DreamTime. Sorry.
This conversation shifted really
suddenly. We were like, Adam, you didn't tell us.
Her studio was named DreamTime and it was attached to DanceWorks.
There it is. There it is.
Okay.
It is.
I didn't sleep enough last night. So, her DreamTime studio inside of DanceWorks. And, you know, as she started doing projects out in the community, I'd be making masks with her. I'd be, you know, exploring the outer reaches of inner space and these different kinds of like conceptual things as I was, you know, in grade school and middle school. And I loved it. I mean, to me, a lot of things that would feel maybe far out or, you know, like hippy dippy or whatever were really like natural to me and how, and that part of my life. And I think in a lot of ways, like sometimes if someone's confused by me, I'll say, oh, sorry, I'm the son of an art therapist. And as if that will help.
That's enough nodding on there. Like,
they'll be like, oh, got it. Yeah.
Got it.
But that was all just my preamble to a specific story where my mom at one point was doing a project that brought her in conversation with Raul Deal. And Raul Deal, a community art professor, longtime professor, art professor at UW Milwaukee, you know, I may be in middle school, and at the time the Kenilworth building wasn't what it is today. Yeah. It was essentially just an old factory building that was kind of that UWM had acquired, but was just kind of like big and open and raw and dirty and, you know, just kind of a classic post-industrial space. And while my mom was meeting with him there, I came along for some reason, and I was just sort of like wandering around like this big empty industrial space. It felt like cavernous, and you know, you see the facades like that every day growing up in Milwaukee. And then Raul was doing a project where he was working with shoe forms, so the things that you mold shoes onto, and like little wooden things. And he had collected thousands of these, or what seemed like thousands. There was like a mountain of these shoe forms. And I'm like in this space, and just to me, that was a story that I thought about every day, but I could draw a through line between that and my work as an adult, which was to not assume from the facade of a building, you know, the universe beyond it. And I think being in that space with this mountain of shoe forms, it felt like a mythical space or something that, you know, like if you walked out onto, you know, tumbled out into the sunlight and told somebody about that, they'd be like, what are you even talking about? so just the what's hiding behind the walls and Raul and whatever project he was doing, I was like, wow, like this was, you know, it was almost like stumbling into the set of a movie.
Yeah.
And it was a building that I, you know, new, walked by almost every day. So
I love it. I love it. It just reminds me of my favorite adages, which is the notion of like, when the strange becomes familiar and the familiar becomes strange, and just the wonder that happens when that happens. And that's what you're saying. This building was hiding in plain sight, in a sense. Like, you walk by this building all the time, you open that door, and there's another dimension. There's another universe that was beyond what you imagined. And stepping into that.
I mean, that became, I wish I had a word that had healthier connotations, but I think it's true. Like, in my adulthood, I developed an addiction to the feeling that you just described, which is like going into a space, going into a home, entering into a story of a person's life. And, you know, Milwaukee, we have this tendency to reduce people to, you know, like one of six possible things, but then just to, you know, be immersed in the totality of a person, not just in they're a one in a million, but kind of even the quotidian in them. Is so freeing, and it's something that it's a feeling that I chase and I like to share all the time.
So. Oh, I love it.
Yeah, I think there's something so I think I sort of draw that to something that we even have been talking about a little bit around the office, right? This idea that like Milwaukee from the exterior is like kind of a sleepy Midwestern kind of post-industrial city. And then you have sort of media sort of telling stories about it as, you know, most segregated, worst outcomes, all that stuff. And then as an outsider, right, I'm not from here. I moved here 10 years ago. And then coming in and sort of becoming close to people in the city itself, all of the randomness, the not random stuff, the everyday stuff, the exciting, like all of that stuff, you get to see the real kind of Milwaukee, right? Which never really gets told. And I think as for someone like you, who, you know, is essentially one of our city's story collectors, right? I think it's such a, what a wonderful kind of like job to have, to be able to collect the stories and to sort of reflect back the insides, right, of Milwaukee to ourselves. I think it's such an interesting position.
So the dynamic you just described of kind of like how outsider and insider can relate to each other. You know, there's a lot of ways I think about this because, you know, as much as I consider Milwaukee my hometown, I'm not going to pretend like on every square inch of the 100 square miles of this city, like I'm like, people who live there will say, oh, this place belongs to you too, you know, like I am kind of, you know, end up being in a position of being a perpetual line stepper. That's kind of been something that's programmed into me my whole life. But so even for I've never said this in anything recorded before, so let me know what you think of this. Is sometimes for local people, for an outsider, we will totally respect them and their expertise, but we won't fully trust them. Local people, though, to other locals, we will trust the mess out of them, but we won't respect them and their perspective because they didn't make it out. So there can be this like, so understand, and that's not good. I'm just making an observation about what I've seen.
It'll be like,
hey, let's spend a lot of money to hire a consultant from one of the coasts to come here to ask questions of people and then write down what they said and then give that to report to the people that spent a lot of money to hire them. And they're like, whoa, this is genius. To me, that pattern, I've seen it enough being here for a while and working across a bunch of different spaces. But like, wouldn't it be great if like, so to me, sometimes the insider, you stop asking good questions in your own living room, right? Mm-hmm. Like the paintings on the wall or the furniture that you might have inherited it and it carries family legacy or whatever it is, but you're not, when you sit on it, you're not processing it every day. So sometimes it takes someone to come in and say, hey, what's that?
Yeah.
And then you're prompted into a story. But I think sometimes us locals can get into a space where we don't like or trust outsiders because we know their opinions are going to be, it's almost reflexive that we don't trust them because we know how much respect they're going to get from those at the top of the hierarchy.
Yeah.
So I think, like, I don't know, just acknowledging that dynamic, I think is the first step in writing a different pattern.
Did you find that? So, by the way, I read the that incredible piece about you in Milwaukee Magazine.
Man,
incredible.
That's a great piece.
Such a great piece.
Props to Mary Lou Schumacher
She had to write about somebody. She had to write about
one of Milwaukee great. One of Milwaukee great.
She had to write some of it.
So, first thing, I was $2,000 away from a scholarship of ending up at Carleton College, by the way. Oh. So you and I would have been alums together. But nice. Did you find that when you went away to Northfield and came back that you had that sense of like outsider kind of suspicion?
That is a great question. So what was very different about Carleton from my experience in Milwaukee, and David, you actually heard me kind of offhandedly remark upon this at the event, but which is that I went to schools growing up that were all predominantly Black and brown and like majority Black for the most part. And so when I got to Carleton, which is, I mean, especially then, I know there's been some progress made in diversity of the student body. It was just a predominantly white culture. And for me, you know, I've always been kind of a code switcher growing up. Mm-hmm. I started switching into the white code, you know, like that, that was the, there wasn't as much code switching. It was like, okay, here's the code. I mean, and occasionally I do it. So I kind of felt when I got back to Milwaukee, there was kind of like this part of me that was used to conversations about race as a contact sport that was fun and oftentimes bruising, but like, you know, that's what I did with my friends in Milwaukee. Yeah. It did feel like some of those muscles had atrophied a little bit. And I'll say too, like when I find myself working in some professional spaces more than others, I'll find that those kinds of like the multicultural scrum that my life was growing up, well, like I'll feel a little less like, oh yeah, I forgot how to do this in the same way. But, you know, I think what Carleton, I don't need to go on this extremely, but like Carleton, my life was so in my head. And what I wanted to find when I came back to Milwaukee was like, how can I be in my body? Not again, because I was always kind of a heady kid, but like, how can I be in the body and in my body and in the world? Like, so how can my education and math and philosophy not take me more and more into a space of sort of like esoteric language, but how can I rather find the language of other people that didn't just isolate me from them? I got a couple mms there. I like it.
I'm digging in.
No, just like digging just in, trying man. To take it in.
That's like a big old steak in front of me. Yeah. And I'm digging in.
Trying to take it in. Yeah.
Well, again, part of that, and again, I'm not speaking for all Asians because Asia is not a monolith or Asian Americans isn't a monolith. But like when you said code switching, I mean, that for me, you know, lit up parts of my brain of I think there's something, you know, navigating predominantly white spaces growing up and then my professional career was much more, you know, much more diverse. I was more based in cities, working youth development, et cetera. I noticed how like, oh, wow, I wasn't code switching as much before. I got pretty comfortable like in some way and I had to come back. And so I think there's something to that. And I also wonder again, you know, and we're kind of pivoting a bit to the main event a little bit is, you know, about the Oriental. I think I grew up in an environment growing up in the Midwest. It's not like growing up necessarily in San Francisco, drink. If you're David again, in the sense that like another David story, but you know, like growing up in a predominantly Asian area, right? Yeah, I grew up probably white area. So it's almost like, I know I'm different. It's my job to fit in or my job not to put up too much of a stink. Cause I just wasn't up for being the obstreperous one or the defining. I'm just trying to get by, man. Right. But yet paying attention, you know, and also recognizing, oh, you know, I don't want to lose myself too much. And so I think what's interesting is, these are just things that are lit up. And I think these are things today we're still navigating as I think more,
for sure,
more identities, right, are being affirmed or being either valid, you know, or like needing to be claimed. And not just race, obviously, there's other dimensions of ourselves that are showing up and they all work together.
I want to say just real quick in response to that, I think in all kinds of conversations need to happen across all kinds of people that us three men, I'm glad we're being vulnerable about some of these things because I think a lot of macho-ness or whatever, like male stigma traps us into like not having the conversation for the level of nuance we're having, or rather just being like, what do you think of the Brewers? And I could talk about the Brewers all day. I've learned, that's a code I know very well, all the sports code. But I just appreciate, we're talking, we're intellectualizing, but we're also talking about feelings.
Isn't that awesome? Three dudes congratulating themselves on how.
I know, and then I was like, yeah, good for us.
Good for us. But wait, as soon as you said out loud, Adam, you knew, like, oh man, I'm naming the thing.
Wait, it's three Asian dudes talking about their Asian experiences, right? I think there's something about that, right? That doesn't feel normal, or not normal, but that happens a lot, right?
Right. Especially here, especially
we ought to have a month. We ought to have a month about it. All right, pivoting to that. Yeah, you spoke about reorienting the Oriental.
Yeah.
Theater. That was an event at the Cultures and Communities Festival that recently took place. And you got to tell us about how you came to speak on a panel with Nancy Wang Wen.
Yeah, I mean, Nancy, I'll be honest, like I am kind of provincial in my work, so I'm very in Milwaukee. And when I looked up who she was, I was like, oh, like, my God, I was very like, wow, like this is like what a get for Milwaukee film to bring in. And this is a person of like really high caliber. And she sent her bio right before the event. And I was like literally started sweating. I was like, oh, my God, I have to be on a stage with this person. But, you know, really, you know, I've haven't done a lot with Milwaukee film over the years, other than just going to the festival and knowing a lot of people who have worked there over the years in different capacities, and just appreciate, you know, what a treasure for the city, the film festival and Milwaukee film in general. And, you know, Kara reached out to me. I saw the email and she invited me to do this. It was it was a long, sensitive email that like explained what was going on. And as I read it, my immediate reaction was like, I don't think I felt like intimidated by the invitation.
Yeah.
And I think to me, I mean, that felt like I should say yes, you know?
You gotta say yes, right? You gotta say yes.
I was like, okay, like this.
If you're this scared, you gotta say yes, right? You gotta go.
And I'll say this, I mean, like this is, during the pandemic, you know, as my professional life, you know, I work behind the scenes at Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and then I do all this other stuff professionally. During the pandemic, it was like, okay, do whatever work is in front of you. And I was doing a lot of Milwaukee storytelling that felt like I was refining and honing the stories that I know about the city, but it felt like I was kind of on home turf all the time. Mm. And this invitation, when she, you know, as I talked to Kara about it a little bit more, I was like, I'm going to have to like stretch my neck out a little bit. I'm going to have to like, you know, this, and I take all the, anytime I say yes to, you know, any kind of gig or job or whatever, I take it very seriously. But this was one where I was like, let's, like the discomfort is almost like the reason to do it.
Yeah.
So that, you know, like if you live and work in Milwaukee, it can be, a lot of times people just seek comfort, and I like staying uncomfortable and staying on my toes.
Mm. Love it.
You'd mentioned in that event that this was the first time in many of your many roles that you got to be Asian, right? Where you sort of were, your Asianness was a part of the deal. You know, here we are, right? You know, just a random assortment of three Asian guys on a podcast in Milwaukee.
Three Asian guys walking to a podcast. That's the joke, right?
In Milwaukee.
You know, but before Mac had mentioned, you know, we were going to like pass some laws as the Asian caucus right now. before we do pass the laws, though, I mean, like, as our city's, you know, quote unquote, a story collector, like, what do you take as Milwaukee's Asian, right, as monolithic as it can be, story, right? Because we have we have Asian communities here that are large and strong and powerful, and, you know, like we have a big history. Like, what is it? It's not the thing that comes to mind, right, when you think about our city. What to you has been like kind of the defining, two or three aspects of what it means to be Asian here?
And I, you know, like, so for me, as in the line of work I'm in and learning Milwaukee story, I'm embarrassed how this isn't something I prioritized in kind of like how I've been deciphering and putting back together the Milwaukee story. I will say this though. I mean, like the Asian story of Milwaukee, and this would be borne out by demographics probably, really is the Hmong community in a lot of ways. So the Hmong community in its story, you know, not just in Milwaukee, but across Wisconsin, and then obviously in California and Minnesota and other places, has been, you know, I grew up around a lot of Hmong people as well. So like in middle school and high school, I had a lot of Hmong folks around as friends. And that is a community that has like, is such, you know, the story of Milwaukee continues to be replenished, reinvigorated through different immigrant groups that have come here. And I can think of no group in 2021 that you can look at like the Hmong community of Milwaukee that says like, obviously Latino community and others, but like the Hmong community of Milwaukee is such an incredible gift to Milwaukee and Wisconsin. I'll say then, you know, like here's what it meant for me. You know, I'm half Chinese, oftentimes considered as an adult to be white passing. Growing up, I had a rounder face. I like people don't, you know, like I didn't have the choice whether I was Asian or not. People are like, oh, you're an Asian kid. And I grew up in these really intentional multicultural environments. So I went to Goldemeyer Elementary School, Morris Middle School, and Ripskin High School, which were places that prided themselves on a lot of things, but the places that embraced the diversity of the city in large part, at least in how they kind of profess their identity. And, you know, so I you know, even being part of a biracial family, I learned multiculturalism as kind of like the gospel of multiculturalism, where in some cases, and this isn't a critique, I'm not trying to cancel multiculturalism, but like it can be like the kids growing up in multicultural environments are told to perform who they are before they've had their, you know, that come to the table and share who you are before you've really had the table to learn on your own without the context of thinking about how you share it.
Yeah.
You know, and what is nice about the environments I grew up in, and sometimes it can be perform your Asianness for a white audience.
That's right.
This was perform your Asianness for a really multicultural audience where there's a bunch of different cultures and all the kids are performing. But I kind of felt like, you know, like I'd go to folk fair and work at the Chinese booth, or I'd go and to the Organization of Chinese American events, or my mom did a lot of volunteer work with the Golden Age Club, which is a group of elders, and like I'd have experiences, but those, they felt kind of like disconnected. And when I would go and visit family in LA, I'd feel like this is the deal, right here. Chinese AF, like meaning Chinese isn't just one thing. It's this
Chinese immigrant,
I feel like a lot of times outside of the Hmong community, to be Asian in Milwaukee is usually to kind of like, I mean, at least for me, is to like kind of perform what that means. And then for those of us who grew up here and aren't coming from a place where it's like, I really know what that means, it can feel sort of performative, as if like you're literally sort of like figuring out what it means as you're telling other people. So I think that, And you know, I'm at fault for that. You know, my mom, after the event, I was talking the other day, she's like, now you want to be Asian.
Like, oh, now it's good. Mom, like, Shang-Chi comes out. Oh, okay. I see how it is.
How much are they paying you? They're paying you well.
I think what's interesting, though, Adam, about that insight, and this kind of relates to the concept, right, of the Oriental theater, right, is that the Oriental as an idea is performative, right? I mean, Oriental doesn't mean, it just means East, right? And
not here. It means not here,
right?
Not like here. It means not here, someplace else.
And when you look at the decor, right, of the theater, it's like kind of like you have a little bit, you have some Buddhas, you got some like, you know, some tigers on the ceiling, you have like kind of like random Eastern, kind of Middle Eastern kind of like architectural elements. And you had mentioned that it struck you as sort of like kitschy, right? Almost like a gimmick, right? Like a professional wrestling gimmick in some ways. and that feels like that is performative, right? I mean, if professional wrestling is nothing if not performing signifiers of stuff, right? To get people to get some heat.
And I, you know, so just I'll do a little bit. This isn't my forte, but I was looking through all this history for the event the other day. You know, the Oriental was created in 1927 as film is becoming this powerful thing that's creating this economy that's spreading out across the country. So, you know, there's theaters that are being built to fulfill this demand, right? So, and in Milwaukee, you know, you have all these little theaters that are being built, but then you have these grand palaces that are being built downtown. And really the point is, you know, they want to present the experience that everyone wants to be a part of, something that's, you know, it was almost this like in the same way I think the churches sometimes I describe as competitive Catholicism. It's like, build your church better and more impressive than the other way people, you know, worship God, so God will see. And that was kind of like the theater is like, build your palace so that the everyone from the worker to the tycoon will need to be in one of those seats and keep coming back. So it really was gimmicks, you know, like the Egyptian or the Venetian, you know, and as, you know, it makes sense. People are coming to escape, as much as people sometimes, including myself, romanticize that era of Milwaukee when there were all these industrial jobs and everyone was able to afford things. It was also really hard work, and it was, you know, that labor, it smelled bad, and it was, you know, your body was used up. So people would want to escape that, so they'd go see movies which were escapist and transportative. So they, you know, the palaces kind of were a mirror of that, what Hollywood was doing as well. So yeah, the Oriental was just like, you know, this was at a time like people didn't have Twitter, they didn't have Instagram, they weren't kind of constantly exposed to all these different things. So like, it was, you know, going into the Oriental was like so unlike the rest of your life. You didn't have access to any of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, probably no, like very few people had ever traveled to any place outside, you know, that might have an aesthetic like that. And, you know, the people who built it were probably the same. You know, they weren't like, we've traveled all over. We've collected all these antiquities and we're going to faithfully recreate them. It was like, you know, let's look in the encyclopedia. Let's make something that looks like that, you know, or like, And to their credit, you know, these were great craftspeople and they created these incredible renderings of things that they knew nothing about. And really to the point of gimmick, to get butts in the seats, you know, it was just like, let's just create a thing that make people feel a certain way. So it is, you know, it's a totally fabricated and invented thing. And to its credit though, you know, like, let's, you know, cancel the Oriental, maybe, probably not. But like, to its credit, I think like it's people who are making it with like, it wasn't a spirit of like, we're ridiculing this. You know, there's been a lot of depictions of Asianness where it's like, haha, look at that. It was like, look at the craft, look at the artistry. And, you know, yeah. And like you said, David, clumsily just sort of like, recreate all these things from all over the place that really don't belong together, except for like, yeah, it's essentially like, you know, the census line Asian, you know, like all in one.
I was making the comparison to my wife that like it would be the same, like how would she feel, right, if she were living if she visited like, I don't know, Taiwan or Hong Kong or something, and there was a restaurant that was like called the Occidental, and it served like spaghetti, fish and chips, and brats, right? Like on a plate together, right? Like, would she feel offended? And she was sort of like, "Yeah, those things don't go together." And I'm like, "Well, see, that's kind of the thing, right? Is that like?"
I in preparation for this event made a whole list of those actually. So
oh, really?
I was like. Eurofest, like, okay, we have Summerfest. Like, what if it wasn't German Fest, Italian Fest, Irish Fest, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's Eurofest. It's in Taiwan. You know, like no one who's putting it on has ever been to any European country or even to the United States to engage with the communities that, you know, the immigrants of that community, whatever. And we're just like making a bunch of money. And it was And you know, to me, whether it's offensive or not, like, maybe that wouldn't be offensive. Maybe someone's like, oh, whatever, you know, it's just them having, like, they're making money off of something, but like, there is something wrong with it. You know, it is like, yeah. So I think, you know, here's a point that even to me, as I was preparing for that event, I was basing it off of 35 years of memories of the Oriental, of, you know, going there as a kid, and it being this kind of dingy, like, kind of run down theater a little bit. And after the renovation, not only do they refresh everything, the lighting is like amazing. So now I'm looking around and I'm seeing things I've never seen before. You know, it wasn't just that we were doing an event. It was like, you literally couldn't see what was off in the corner and up on the ceiling because the lighting wasn't there. So now it's like even more like, when Nancy was looking around, she said, wow, this is a little much. And I was like, yeah, it's loud now. Like the Orientalness is even louder after the renovation. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, Adam. Like, you know, not that I get asked this a lot, but this notion of like, how do you feel about the Oriental Theater? And I just would take a deep breath, right? And I go like, well, and it's kind of like, you know, you really put words to kind of my mindset. I was like, it's not, and again, I'm not trying to defend it. I'm just trying to put it in context. It's acknowledging a time and place where the exoticism of something, that's really what it's sort of almost honoring. Or commemorating. Now, okay, whether or not that's worthy of commemorating, it's an interesting question. But it's one of those things where, like, I don't get hung up on it. Then I wonder, am I being bad Asian if I'm not getting hung up on it? But there's a vibe where I'm like, I guess I've the way I go to sleep at night, I'm like, I'm kind of saving my powder for the other stuff because I just don't have it in me to get, like, fired up. But I get, as David said, somebody may get, like, it may be reductive, and I don't doubt that. But at the same time, there's a part of fatigue I have. I'm going, man, given all the stuff we're kind of working on.
Right.
That's kind of where
the hill. Yeah. So that, I mean, that
I don't even want to don it. I just don't even want to turn my ankle on this hill. You know what I mean? Like, it's there's a lot going on, man. You're like,
I did ask myself that question. Like, am I being a bad Asian for
not canceling.
Right. So I've known some like really activist minded, radical artist, really cool people that have, like, Asian folks in Milwaukee that have all left, that have gone, like, you know, this isn't a huge number of people. Like, I think they all have gone to Detroit by now, like, maybe following, like, I know some of them specifically following Grace Lee Boggs, but like, like, to me, I was like, if those people were here and I was talking to them about this, they'd be like, are you kidding me?
Get
rid of the Oriental right now. Like, stop having all this equivocating, intellectualizing, like, oh, we understand where the language comes from and it's part of history. It's like, no, that's what white people do to us. Like, let's not play their game. So so that voice was itching me and being like, oh, is Nancy going to hear my presentation and being like, oh, this guy sucks?
Adam, you pretty much play out a lot of my life in professional time.
I know.
Man, this guy sucks. Like, that drives me to stay up an extra hour to get my notes tighter.
Trying to avoid
that guy sucks.
I was in this room and I was up to like 2 or 3, like, working on the notes, being like, I need to equip myself. But, you know, like, but you know, that, to me, though, I do think there, I will say, and this has been sinking into me after the event, because I didn't spend much time in the renovated theater. It is kind of a different conversation now that they've renovated it. Like, I kind of wrote my presentation or my thoughts about the Oriental, which was more or less, you know, David, you can share your take on the Oriental. I, like, of everything I heard, I really thought what you said, like rung true to me. I spoke to a lot of other people who were kind of like, you know, like, we should, you know, people in the Asian community were thinking like, we should change the name or at least understand that this is a prompt for education and maybe more fundamentally, like, dialogue, obviously, but like to consider things that might be more important about, like, which are like opportunity, right? Like, how are there or aren't there opportunities for Asian filmmakers and across what happens in the city. And so like in that is just another thing to think. It's like, well, if they're going to change the name after they spend all the money on the decor, like, are you going to walk into a theater that's named the insert rich person's name here or whatever they name it? I don't think they'll do. Well, who knows? But I mean, then you walk in And it's Oriental Theater. Be like, what? Like,
still, that's a weird. Still the same thing. Still the same.
So that'd be like, I mean, that would be even weirder. So like, are they going to change all the decor? Are they, you know, is, yeah. So David, will you share just a little bit of your perspective on it? Because that
I just think it's, I mean, you'd said it a little bit, right? It's an opportunity to do some education and to talk about and highlight all of the incredible voices and faces of cinema throughout East, South Asia that have always been sort of marginalized and not seen, right? And how do you, and I think the win, right, ultimately is how do you incorporate more Asian throughout the Asian sort of experience in the content that's being highlighted through Milwaukee Film, right? That's the win, because I mean, they have obviously Black Lens, Sin Fronteras, like a ton of tracks in their film festivals. Like, what is the Asian voice in that, right? And I think that's really powerful. And I think in some ways that the Oriental as a name for theaters is so sort of associated with a certain style of theater, right? I mean, like, I don't know. I mean,
LA, right? Grauman's Chinese theater.
LA, there are a number of Oriental theaters. Right. I mean, I was just going to mention that the one in Chicago was just renamed the Niederlander, right? Like, maybe the Niederlanders are going to just buy up all of your, I don't know, right? What do you do? Cancel the Venetian, like the Egyptian, like they're all of these theaters of a historical architectural style that is connected to, I think, movie tradition, right? Movie palaces, and to be able to utilize that as an opportunity to highlight all of the incredible artistry and creativity amongst Asians, I think, is just an incredible opportunity.
I 100% agree with you. And I don't know how much longer we're going to be able to podcast, but I do want to talk about wrestling.
Yeah.
We use the term.
Adam, maybe you want to keep your powder dry on this, because we might actually have a wrestling podcast.
We want you back. Channel. We want you back, man.
Yeah, we will want you back.
Okay, well, yeah. I have plenty more material. But, you know, and so this was funny. So I'm preparing for this, and I ended up not using it very much in my presentation, but I was trying my material out a little bit on David, as it were, like, we did a phone call. Yeah. And you were so, David, you were so helpful in that phone call as we were preparing for this event. But I just wanted to float an idea past him, and then I didn't know I could open up. We're going to start a whole new podcast because of it.
Yes.
Was I wanted to compare the Oriental theater just to professional wrestling, which is, you know, wrestling is this fic. It's, you know, comes from carnies. It's about getting people to engage in these fictions that they know are fictions, but also like they're participating in the fiction, and it's fun and it's silly and it's stupid and it's base, and oftentimes there's incredible melodrama. If you're doing it right, it's not dramatic, it's melodramatic.
So
to me, as I was thinking about the Oriental theater and essentially like all these gimmicks that these movie palaces were opening under, it felt so much like what the creative meetings inside of WWE must be like. Like, okay, we got this guy. Where is he from? He's Asian, or he's Black, or he's white. Is he Irish? Cool. Give him an Irish gimmick, and then you get Sheamus. And for those of you who don't like wrestling, I'm going to start using some specifics. You know, like, so like Shinsuke Nakamura is this incredible wrestler out in Japan. This who's just like his gimmick is weird, violent Muppet rock star. Psychedelic, just the best, and vicious. He comes to the U.S. and, you know, he maintains some of that, but like any Asian wrestler in professional wrestling in the WWE at least has always just had to be that some version of the Asian guy. It's like or Mexican wrestlers or something.
And
you know, like sometimes it's pulling from what happens in Japan or in Mexico in those wrestling traditions, but it ends up being sort of like. This performative thing where your gimmick is just, it's reductive.
Yes.
And I will say I think the revelation of that is the New Day, and now I'm just not talking about the Oriental at all.
No, this is good. No, you may have.
New Day,
Like we were talking about the New Day just last week. So
the New Day are these incredible wrestlers who aren't quite finding their place. They find together, and then Vince McMahon's like, "You're going to be preachers," and it's like, "Oh,
deep sigh, deep
like
sigh."
Three black guys doing that. Like, dude, come on! Like it's like just another trope. You know, it's going to be like black power or whatever.
Yeah.
And then they lean. You know, they're supposed to be like preaching the power of positivity, but they go so deep into it, they become bad guys, and then everyone loves them because their commitment's just like,
yeah, like that's it,
out of this world. And
the
then
commitment
becomes,
level that's what they are,
psychedelic and weird, and they're
the unicorns,
and they're like just doing whatever, and like, and all of a sudden it becomes something they love because they like they break a gimmick, and I think to me like that's the gold standard of like, okay, someone wants to box me in. How am I going to take that?
Yes.
Go so deep into it, turn it into such a character that's not, it just morphs into something totally different where it is something that I love and can be an expression of myself. Understanding like how can you play with the gimmick and like, so like the Oriental, as you look at it, the theater, it's truly a wrestling gimmick. It's just like, like in like a 70s wrestling gimmick. It's like costume guy.
Yeah,
we have an Asian, like Ricky the Dragon Steamboat isn't a great example, but like we got an Asian and we need him to be Asian, so like throw together some dragons and look up some, go to the library and find some symbols and we'll put them on their gear, and like that person's probably a great artist, you know what I'm saying, like and then they're creating this gimmick, and you know that's and I think like part of me, you know, I feel like if you love the Oriental theater, this might feel like sacrilegious, like, or if you love historic preservation, like, no, we're honoring the craft of the past, but like, let's not pretend it's something that it isn't. Like it is incredible. Like the craftspeople who did that stuff or the Triple I Shrine, like I go in there and I'm like, oh, this is awful, but man, the tile work in here is pretty. Like, and I'm sure like someone might come who's deeply steeped in that tradition and be like, dang, like they went off in here, but also like that's not good. but yeah, so like so to balance, like, yeah, so like I do sometimes have some qualms with preservationism because it kind of decides that the moment we should preserve are the baptismal moments of buildings, which were when the city was all white. So I do think like Arijit Sen, another let's invite him into our Asian guy power conversation here. But Arijit Sen, who's an architecture professor at UW Milwaukee, he points out like, you know, like let's not just preserve buildings. Let's also have a cultural lens of like how can we also preserve important cultural contributions in places? Because if we're just going to preserve buildings, one of the things that does is that people who are very building focused will view the present inhabitants who aren't putting the work into keeping them up as somehow denigrating them. But yeah, so I just went off on a lot of different tangents. So wrestling.
This is this is really good, and I think
so many tendrils I want to pull upon.
This really I think reminds us that we should definitely have you back as a recurring guest, if not just book you as a monthly to sort of continue to pull on some of these tendrils. I think there's just a lot here. Super interesting.
I love it, man. So energized. Oh, we got to ask you this question. We ask everybody, right. And I think I want you to have this power. You are, in a way, a czar of arts and culture.
That's right.
Storytelling, at least the very least. We had
the OG right now, right?
You want to expand it.
Yeah.
The power only lasts as long as this podcast episode. So you got to work quick, Adam. What is the policy you'd pass as our city's czar of arts and culture?
You know, I am. I have made my living for a while in Milwaukee doing different freelance work and gigging work in the arts and culture space. And one thing I wish that existed for all of us were a set of standard rates that acknowledged, you know, like if you're a new worker, here's how much you should charge per hour or per day or whatever it is. If you're a more experienced worker, here's where you are. I'll say this. We were talking about John Gerda before the podcast opened. John Gerda has always been really generous to me as a mentor. I went to high school with his son, and we've sat down and talked, and you know, him and I aren't like talking every day or anything, but he, you know, one time he sat me down and like, he was just like, here's how much I charge for tours. And what he was telling me was probably two things. Is like, one, don't depress the rate for tours.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
two, get paid, dude. Right. So yeah. like,
you're worth it. You're worth it. Right?
Yeah. And like, I'll work with younger professionals or people who are deeper into their careers than me. And when I'm working with younger professionals, I'll walk them through as we're making a proposal for something. I'm like, here's how much we're going to charge. Yeah. And like, we're not gonna, and if they say no, maybe we negotiate or maybe we just walk away.
Yeah.
And I learned that from people who are more established than me of yeah. how to engage in those negotiations. But like yeah. the fact that it's a negotiation every time feels stupid to me. So yeah. like maybe it should That's be, right. here's a day rate for videographers and photographers. Here's a day rate for, and these are labor standards that exist. And there doesn't even need to be a union. It's just, I don't know. So I'm the czar, right? So I just yeah. get the.
you got it.
So I just
decree.
And also too, because sometimes I'll see younger professionals and who will be charging a really high rate, and I'm like, I want you like, I'm not saying that like go and get it if that's what you can get.
Yeah.
But also like. Also, yes. Yeah. So there's like essentially that there would be like transparency ultimately.
Yeah. Go get so it if that's what you can get, but you better not suck because right. then you're going to mess it up for the rest of us.
And come on. Like, no, I, right. Because that's something to think. And I was just telling someone this is that people who volunteer labor, like, so say you're a tenured professor or something and you could do something for free, like, still send them a pro bono invoice or something so that the next right. time they're looking for someone, they're like, oh no, but I thought people just did this from the community. You yeah, know, like...
we have a volunteer who's a high level researcher volunteering for us. We're actually putting him on our budget at what we would pay him and the revenue of his volunteer time, just so people on when they look at our budget, they can see that somebody is spending time with us, and he's given us that time as a resource, and this yeah. is what we would have paid.
Yeah,
if
in that.
Did.
That that kind of practice. So I'm glad, I mean, of all people, imagine MKE, you should be doing that. So I'm glad you're doing that, right? Like, yeah, yeah. no, of like yeah. of moving the sector forward,
yeah.
like these kinds of labor standards are something where it almost can be like taboo, you know, like,
right.
do you want, like, can we talk about with each mm. other? And like, you only talk about your good friends about how much you charge or mm. someone you're collaborating with. And like, I just think that if there were a set of standards that were more normalized or more established, it would be good for all of us. And yeah. obviously people could exist without outside of it. You know, yeah. like someone could say, well, you know, I'm going to charge much more than that. And that's okay. But it just, if there were this kind of like mm-hmm. baseline in place. So.
Right. And protect those who've been underselling themselves. Right. And protect, you know, cause again, that's every time it's a negotiation, it's an opportunity for some sort of thing.
No, happen, for
right?
sure.
I yeah, mean, like, so I think that's,
I mean, when I was getting started, I'd have my rates all over the place. And there's sometimes where like, I mean, I'll just own up to this. I mean, even recently someone asked me like, hey, can you do this thing? And I was like, yeah, you think I could do it for this much? And they're a friend of mine. And they're like, how about I pay you twice as much? And I was like, damn it. like I need to like,
don't.
yeah. Like, oh, I should have thought about where your address is of your building. Cause that, I mean, that would be the other thing is like, there should be a sliding scale as well.
Yeah.
Cause I will always do work for free until for the rest yeah. of my career. For people that I want to do work with That's because true. I want to. And, you know, if I'm working in a community setting or a nonprofit where, you know, like how much I'm charging is a lot for them, I'm not going to be like, well, actually my rate's up here, you know? Right. So, but yeah, just having something in place so that the conversation doesn't feel like it's emotional, you know, like those kinds of things, like mm-hmm. it should just be like, you know, like here's what it is.
Yeah.
And it can be like, oh, should I do this? Should I do that? And yeah, so
I'd rather, for a lot I'd rather of have you spend your emotion and time on the craft itself.
Absolutely,
focus on yeah. the craft, man. Like sure. we don't. This is a transaction, man. Adam, it's like I said, I'm juiced. Let's keep. I would love to keep talking, and we'll probably have Easter eggs about all the press. how can the audience find you? How can our loyal listener base find you?
I'm around. I've done such a bad job of representing myself places because people find me. So like, you know, I would say that was the worst plug ever.
So your publicist is burying his. I wish,
yeah,
and just
which is me. So I should feel ashamed. I will say this, you know, I work behind the scenes at Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and that is a project I really, I believe in. And I'll just say this, even some of what I just shared as my idea for Azara, I kind of cribbed probably bits and pieces of it from an alum of Imagine MKE, which is Kenita Hickman, who recently wrote an op-ed for us. So so I read Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm overexposed.
I love it.
Like, don't look for me. Look for other people.
We will direct people to look for you at the bars after State Fair. That is where we will direct people to look for you.
Yes, for sure. And I don't even drink. So look for the guy with a dusty O'Doul.
Yeah.
And you have license to say hi.
Adam, it's been a joy and a pleasure. Thanks for hanging with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, man.
So, David, I mean, I'm a little jealous that you got to talk to Adam Carr, but I'm wondering, as you reflect on the conversation, what's something he said that most surprised you that you want to mull over some more?
You know, as you heard, there are a couple of moments where he dropped some truth bombs on Mac and I, and we sort of just sat there with that long right, which I think made him a little bit nervous because we were just really trying to kind of like. Listen in and kind of feel into those thoughts. I think the thing that really sort of stuck with me though is this. I think this truth that he noted about our community, right, which is this idea that Milwaukee respects the opinions of outsiders but doesn't trust them, and then for locals it doesn't respect their opinion but trusts them a lot. And I wonder if that continues to be kind of. Some of the kind of, you know, a little bit of that underdog nature that we have, that we sort of have a little bit of anxiety about how we show up in national settings with other cities of our size, how we're compared and how we feel about ourselves. And that actually reminds me, Lindsay, with the Travel Writers Convention coming up, like that feels like a really interesting opportunity, right? Because we're going to bring in all of these folks, right, to Milwaukee to talk about Milwaukee. Really excited about some of your work that you're going to be doing at the Travel Writers Convention towards that end.
Yeah, that's right. We have this opportunity to present some, not all, of Milwaukee's arts and culture. Abundance and strength to folks coming to town for the sole purpose of strengthening their craft as travel writers and also experiencing Milwaukee and hopefully taking away some stories that they want to dive into while they're here and then also after. So excited for that opportunity and to see what comes of it. So stay tuned for hopefully some pretty incredible coverage on Milwaukee in the coming weeks.
You know who I think gives Milwaukee incredible coverage, Lindsay?
Our listeners.
Of course, our listeners. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review, or contact us directly at pod@imaginemke.org.
Imagine This Podcast is produced, edited, and hosted by MacArthur Antigua, David Lee, and Lindsay Sheridan, and is the flagship of the Imagine MKE Podcast Network. You can catch some back episodes of Black Imagination and Arts Forward MKE, and all of this can be found at imaginemke.org/podcasts.
To catch all the latest from Imagine MKE, hit us up on Twitter and Instagram at @imagine_MKE or Facebook at @imaginemke. Thanks again, and we will catch you next Tuesday when Greg Bach joins us to talk about the Milwaukee Comedy Fest. Can't wait for that. Talk to you later.
Bye.